From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the Pentagon tells us there's zero tolerance for military sexual assaults, but the numbers tell a different story.
In 2014, we had about 20,000 sexual assaults. Of those 20,000 sexual assaults, probably about 200 people are convicted.
Plus, beyond the battlefield and onto a new life on the college campus.
It's like when the Super Bowl ends and you turn off the TV. There's just this sudden silence.
Why Facebook will not let you use an assumed name, transparency, or dollars and cents.
They need for you to have a trackable, consistent identity across social media so that they can target ads to you.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. For years now, we've heard the Pentagon tell us there is zero tolerance for sexual assault. So, why hasn't the rate of sexual assault changed in half a decade?
Those who oppose fundamental change keep saying we need to hold commanders more responsible. The reality is it's impossible to hold commanders responsible.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, fighting back against sexual assault in the military. But first, we cheer them as we welcome them home from Afghanistan or Iraq. But what is there for troops when it's time to transition back to civilian life? That's the question now as we continue our series Beyond the Battlefield. Sherman Powell served in the Army from 1995 to 2006, first as an infantry officer, then as a tank officer. He was among the first veterans to return home from the Iraq War. From 2006 to 2008, he was part of the Armed Forces Association at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. Welcome to the program, Sherman.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
11 years in the Army. I'm wondering, before you left, when you were still in the Army, but you knew that it was the time was approaching, what were your worries and concerns about going back to civilian life?
To be honest, one of my biggest concerns was that I might not quite stay in the best physical shape of my life when I didn't have to wake up at 4:30 or 5 every morning and go work out every day and do all those things that you have to do just without even thinking about it in the service. More importantly, though, I was concerned about the loss of a community, the loss of a sense of teamwork and shared purpose and doing important and difficult things with like-minded people. I felt at the ripe age of 34 that I had achieved all of my life's ambitions. I'd gotten to do great things in difficult environments in numerous places around the world, both Korea, Iraq, and in numerous locations in the U.S., and just achieved tremendous results. But once that was over, and I knew as it was coming to a close that it would be very, very difficult, if not impossible, to ever replicate that environment, that sense of teamwork, shared purpose, shared ideals, and shared values. And it might be a little bit tougher going forward.
Once you were out, was it strange? Was it hard?
I wouldn't say strange or hard. You know, again, there were a lot of it we knew to expect.
What did you know? What did you expect?
We knew it would be awfully quiet. We knew that the level of intensity and the level of constant exertion, constant awareness of your environment,
vigilance.
Constant. Sure, sure.
Yeah.
The constant need to look at your plan for the day, to synchronize your plan with everybody around you, to adapt to and integrate all of the changes that happen throughout the course of a day or even the course of a few hours or a few minutes. That just level of intense exertion and energy and concentration was going to vanish overnight, and it did. Again, it's like when the Super Bowl ends and you turn off the TV, there's just this sudden silence.
Now, you came to the Ross School of Business, and you were part of this group, the Armed Forces Association, which was the predecessor of the SVA, the Student Veterans Association, which I understand began at the University of Michigan and then spread nationwide. How important can a group like the Student Veterans Association be to someone who's reentering and is pursuing education?
Sure, immensely important. It can be vitally important. And for one basic reason, which is that when a veteran leaves the service after 2 years or 5 years or 10 or 20, whatever the amount of time might be that they served, and they suddenly find themselves on a college campus, which is the case with people who started and who now are members of the SVA, it's not that it's a difficult environment. It's not that it's dangerous. It's not that it's hostile really in any way. But the difficulty that some people have is the fact that there is not a sense of community. You are surrounded by people who are in some ways complete strangers, in many ways complete strangers, and who have very, very different backgrounds, very different life experiences. Not that you're better than them. In the case of undergraduates, for example, the average undergrad veteran is maybe 3 or 4 years older than the average undergrad who's not a veteran. And so, you know, there's an age difference and there's a life experience difference. And so it can be a little bit tough to find the basis to start basic relationships. And so that's the challenge I think a lot of veterans face. They find themselves scratching their heads at some of the things they see and some of the behavior. It's just different than what they have been around for many years. Again, I'm not trying to say.
Yeah, you're not making a judgment call here.
That's
but
right.
The fact that you were shot at Fallujah is a different base of experience from somebody who was not and who was several years younger and who kind of went from high school right into college. It's just different.
For sure, for sure. In the grad school environment, it's a little bit different because there are just so many different backgrounds that people come from and so many paths they take before winding up at grad school that you're one of many people who has a very, very different background, an unconventional background. But again, for the undergrads, I think it's more pronounced, the difference. Mm-hmm. And so what they are looking for, what they were looking for was a group of like-minded people, a community with whom they could share and reflect upon their experiences in a common language without having to explain everything from square one and sort of process those experiences and think about how they're going to adapt and pursue the rest of their lives.
So I'm interested because I think you're in a good position, Sherman Powell, to decide what's working and what isn't as vets transition into civilian life. You did it in the mid-2000s, but I'm wondering, what's different for vets today? Is there more in place? Are things better, do you think, than when you were making the transition, support system and training, or are there deficits?
There's definitely more in place now than there was 6 or 8 or 10 years ago. When I arrived in Ann Arbor for the first time in the summer, fall of 2006 and walked into the VA hospital, for instance, I was practically the first person they had ever seen or heard from in the OIF-OEF generation. I mean, there was practically nobody there who knew what to do. And I had to ask, you know, the basic questions. Hi, I'm here. Where do I go to get the ID card? Where do I go to sign up for one thing or another that I'm supposed to do?
So you really were on the vanguard of the Iraq vets coming back.
Correct. Correct. I may not have been the very first, but mm-hmm. it certainly felt like it. Mm-hmm. And by just a year or two later, what had started out as a trickle had turned into a flood. And that's when you started to hear about things like the backlog in disability claims and things like that. The GI Bill, the post-9/11 GI Bill, for instance, I think was passed around 2008 timeframe. And that all really started from scratch. All of the work that went into that and all the other programs that are in place now started from practically nothing around 05, 06 timeframe. So it was interesting to be there at the very beginning of that.
Let me ask you, what do you think is the single most important thing we, and I mean all of us as well as our government, can do to help veterans make that good, successful transition back to civilian life?
Well, I don't know necessarily that I could speak to that as much as I can speak to the micro issues, the mm-hmm. things I saw and experienced mm-hmm. during my transition home. As a grad school student, as a business school student, it was really, really nice to show up on campus and in my first week or two at the business school, start going to meetings with this group that we call the Armed Forces Association. That was neat to be able to get together and maybe get a drink or two or five and tell war stories and talk about the things we saw and did. You know, where were you when this happened? Oh, well, I was over here. Well, that's neat because I was right there. You know, I'm amazed we didn't run into each other. You know, that type of thing.
And that's what was happening at the VFW halls after World War II and after Korea and, right?
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Absolutely. We helped each other in a lot of ways. We reviewed resumes. We did mock interviews because the overwhelming focus of the business school is getting your resume straight and getting ready for interview season, which starts almost immediately, and getting your summer job and then getting your full-time offer and moving on onwards and upwards in the world. And that's what the business school is built around. And so as a community, we were immensely helpful to each other in that regard. We got offers from Amazon, from Google, from Procter & Gamble, from all the biggest consulting firms and Wall Street banks. And again, as business school veterans, we succeeded tremendously, thanks in large part to one another. On the undergraduate side, it was a completely different story, a night and day difference.
You've said to us that the single most important thing people can do for vets is job prep and job interviewing training.
Sure.
And this is before they leave?
Correct. Before they leave the service.
The service? Or just have it available at some point?
Yeah. It's really, really tough to do that kind of thing as you're on your way out of the door mm-hmm. because many people who are leaving the service are in a rush to do so. You know, your entire life is turning upside down and you kind of want to get through it as quickly as you can. get signed out of the base, get your uniform off, get moved out of there and on to the next thing. And so most people I know who were leaving the service didn't really spend a lot of time lingering. Once you get to a college campus, though, if that's what you've chosen to do with yourself after you leave the service, you've got time. You've got between 2 and 4 years mm-hmm. to sit down and think about what your values are, think about the things you care about, think about starting a family and doing all those things that you want to do in your early, mid, late 20s. And you've got a couple of year time frame before the real world takes over and before the immediate financial pressures and crises that you experience in the real world start to define you. And so you've got a little bit of a window there to do something with yourself, to position yourself for the future. And again, 6 or 8 years ago, 9 years ago, 10 years ago, when the SVA was first getting started, there was absolutely nothing in place to help people take their experiences, take their accomplishments, the equipment they worked with, the things they were a part of, and actually put those onto a resume and shape those and mold those into a 5 or 10 word bullet that anybody, any civilian, any corporate recruiter or hiring manager can instantly read and understand and make sense of. There wasn't anything like that. Even now, 8 or 10 years later, it's still a challenge, I think. We hold resume workshops for the student veterans group. We do a lot of things like that, but there still isn't as much of a structure in place to help these folks who have done great things around the world at a very young age in huge positions of responsibility to take that experience and translate it and market it effectively to get them to the next step, to get them to the next stage.
Sherman, thank you so much for sharing your story with us and talking with us.
Thanks for your time as well.
Sherman Powell is a veteran of 11 years in the Army. He now runs an Ann Arbor-based startup called Army Property. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's called the Real Name Policy. Facebook's had it in place since 2006. CEO Mark Zuckerberg said the policy's there to protect us for transparency, to cut down on fake or spam accounts. Critics say, though, we should be able to use whatever name we want on the social networking site. Michigan Radio social media producer Kimberly Springer is here. We've been hearing now Facebook's been shutting out users who may not be using their real name.
Yes, because Facebook has three things at stake with this real name policy. The first is authenticity. So they want realness in their social encounters. And research has found that people value that in a social network, that they're getting an authentic experience. So the second thing that Facebook says is at stake is safety. And so they see using real names as an anti-bullying, anti-harassment measure.
And I can see that because, trolls can hide behind any old name and you have no idea.
Right. But the research varies on that. Mm. Some research says that people are less likely to harass somebody if they use their real name. But you can find research that says the opposite. So we're still out on that.
Okay.
And then the third thing would be, of course, money. This is the one thing that Facebook does not state is at stake. They need for you to have a trackable, consistent identity across social media so that they can target ads to you.
So because we all remember when we're using Facebook, we're the product.
Exactly. You learned that lesson.
I have, which makes me kind of smile when I see people rant and rave about whatever policy Facebook institutes because it's their sandbox and they're selling us.
Exactly.
So this real name policy means exactly what?
Facebook had to make a distinction between real names and legal names because initially they just said, we want you to use your real name because people want you to be authentic. But then people had the counter argument that, well, if I'm being harassed, I might want to use a pseudonym on social media so that I can enjoy this space.
Sure.
So really, it's a matter of perspective. From Facebook's perspective, they're thinking about people who might perpetrate bullying. Mm. But then consumers are thinking about whether they're going to be the ones who are being bullied.
And this is not a new policy, right? But it's one of those things that it's been baked in there for a while and we just click accept and move on and we
exactly.
don't read it all.
and it's had to evolve because Google Plus had this problem when they came on the scene in 2011. And their users really pushed back against this real name policy. So they got rid of it after 3 years completely.
So what's happening in the real world? What's making people complain to Facebook?
This first came to my attention because drag performers, you know, people who mm-hmm. perform drag on stage, wanted to use their stage names on Facebook. And Facebook was saying, no, you need to use your real name. And so there's a distinction there because they're performers. They could have a professional page. But then there are people who are transgender who might be transitioning into a different gender or a new identity. And so they want to change their names on Facebook as well. So now where Facebook has come down is to make this distinction between legal name and your real name. And they're saying, we want you to use your real name. So what is it that your friends call you?
Well, all right. Let's say I open up a Facebook page and I call myself Tsarina Empress Choo Choo. How does Facebook know that that's not my real name? Are they watching every page that's up? I mean, how do they know?
Things like Tsarina Empress Choo Choo or Batman, those are things that signal to them. Those are not real names.
And there are people watching this.
There's probably an algorithm watching it that mm-hmm. then flags it, that then deactivates your account if you do that.
Have people been asked to submit documentation of names?
Right. So then they've had to come up with these procedures where you submit your legal documents and they tell you you can cross out and redact any sensitive information like social security numbers, etc. But, you know, it's just this minefield of, you know, government documentation, personal issues, commerce. It's a bit of a mess.
Is there a solution to this? Because I totally understand the idea of I want to know who I'm talking to. I don't want to be talking to somebody that I think is named John Smith and I mm-hmm. find out it's anything but. But I also understand if I am trying to duck a stalker or an abusive ex that I would like to enjoy my social media without having to worry right. about being tracked down.
You know, it's tricky because like you said, this is a free service. This is their mm-hmm. sandbox. So, you know, the alternative is to not use it and to maybe think about other ways that you want to connect with the people in your life. Because ultimately, I mean, Facebook isn't a public utility. It's not required in our lives. Neither is Google Plus. But there might be ways that you can interact with people on Instagram and still keep in touch with them. So I would suggest looking for alternatives to Facebook if that's your concern.
One of our producers, Mike Blank, said, how about if we just start a new social network, call it Fakebook, and it could let you stay anonymous?
I think that might already exist.
Well, so it's worth knowing if you are thinking of setting up a page or setting up a second page, mm-hmm. It has to be a name that everyone would recognize you by.
Right. It has to be a legitimate, and you're doing air quotes, legitimate uh-huh. name.
Forewarned is forearmed. Kimberly Springer is Michigan Radio's social media producer. Thanks so much, Kimberly.
You're welcome.
This is the future.
You built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
It's alive! It's alive!
It's the sound of science!
Michigan is certainly not alone in the struggle to repair crumbling roads and bridges. It is a nationwide challenge. The American Society of Civil Engineers has given America's infrastructure a grade of D based on years of underfunding and delayed maintenance. Victor Lee might have the key to turn that D into an A. The University of Michigan Civil and Environmental Engineering professor has invented self-healing concrete. It can bend, and if it cracks, it can repair itself. Victor Lee, welcome.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
In order for us to understand what is in your self-healing concrete, explain to us what's in the concrete that we're all familiar with and we've seen for years.
Mm-hmm. Well, the main ingredients in concrete material is the binder, which is typically a Portland cement, and it binds together aggregates, which are basically sands and so on. And then there are some other chemical admixtures that makes it work all together.
And the problem when we get all the potholes and the crumbling, kind of take us through what's happening to cause that.
Mm-hmm. Well, fundamentally, concrete is a brittle material. When I say brittle, it really means brittle, like glass, for example. So we are all familiar with glass. It doesn't like to be deformed. If you try to bend a piece of glass, it simply fractures. Mm-hmm. Right? And this is very unlike, for example, a metallic material, which has some ductility, meaning that it's allowed to be deformed into and bent out of shape, for example. Mm-hmm. You think of a piece of paperclip, for example, you can bend it out of shape and it will still maintain its whole piece together.
Correct.
That's not the case with glass. And concrete is brittle like glass. So if you try to press on it, bend it, it will fracture. And once cracked, then everything starts to go bad. So for example, once a crack is formed, and usually it can go from very small millimeter size all the way to centimeter size. Mm-hmm. We see that all the time on pavements and sidewalks and so on.
Now more than ever.
Exactly. And once you have such a large crack, water goes through those cracks. In Michigan, we use a lot of road salts and the chloride ions that goes along with the salt also enters the crack. And with oxygen and also carbon dioxide from air, it forms just the perfect environment for the corrosion of steel. And once steel corrodes, it expands. It turns into an iron oxide, expands against the surrounding material, putting more tension into the concrete and causing further cracking. And sometimes we call those spallings. Whole chunks of concrete spall out and expose the corroded reinforcements. So that's the typical kind of deterioration process occurring in concrete with steel inside. Even without steel, concrete simply cracks and crumbles very easily under load
and
because
thus,
it's brittle.
So brittle. And thus the road problems we're seeing, as we found out, not just in Michigan, but really across the country. So how does your self-healing concrete differ?
Well, it differs in the sense that it controls its cracking and then it mends it. So to explain this, it's easier perhaps for your audience to understand if we have small cuts on our fingers or our hand.
Like a paper cut.
A paper cut, mm-hmm. Yes.
They sting when you get them.
Exactly. So it's kind of damage, but mm-hmm. we don't go to the hospital because we expect it to self-heal. So that's really a marvelous thing of nature. We have the capability of self-healing. Of course, if you do a big cut, mm-hmm. that's a different story. Then you have to go to the hospital. So the inspiration is, how do we maintain our cracks so small that it can reheal itself in concrete material, similar to our skin material? How do we turn that into something like that? And that's where another kind of natural material helps us. And that is the inside of the abalone shell. This is the iridescent colored material, like rainbow, if you look inside the shell of an abalone. You see that there's this colorful layer which is called nacre. And nacre is a wonderful, wonderful material. It's actually fundamentally also brittle material. It's actually made out of calcium carbonate, similar to chalk that we use to write on the blackboards. And these are brittle material, but nature makes it into a ductile material. How does it do that? Well, it turns out inside nacre, if you look at it under the microscope, you see that there are lots of layering of this material. And these layers, some people call it brick layering techniques. So they actually can move and slide over one another if you overly load the material. So nature has this abalone shell, very tough, but because of the interlayering, it slides and deforms and it accommodates that movement very well. And so we took that and we put a lot of interfaces into this bendable concrete. And it's done by using microfibers and coatings on the fibers in such a manner that if you overload this bendable concrete, it will also slide inside. It will cause this very small, minute motions inside that makes it macroscopically look like a metallic material. So it's actually can deform it out of shape.
So it's more it's resilient.
It's very resilient. Yes, that's an excellent word. It's very resilient to overloading, large loading.
And then how does it heal itself? I'm gathering the fact that it's very resilient means those cracks aren't as big. They're more like the paper cut.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. That's the whole point. So if you overload a piece of bendable concrete instead of a big fracture like normal concrete, it actually distributes the damage into many, many minute micro cracks similar to the paper cut on our skin. And then, because of the very tiny size of these micro cracks, it can undergo self-healing with just a very simple chemistry. And the chemistry is the continued hydration of the cement particles that are not yet used inside. And it reacts with the external water or carbon dioxide, even from air. Just those elements can cause healing. It forms a glue, basically, and connects the two sides of the micro cracks and basically healed it. Just like the healing of paper cuts on our hand.
That is brilliant. Have you been able to test this on a road surface?
To a certain extent, yeah. So the material has been placed on a patch on Curtis Road in Ann Arbor, and it has worked very well. We actually did a side-by-side comparison between the new material and regular repair mortars on the same bridge deck. And obviously, they are exposed to the same kind of harsh environment on that bridge, particularly is heavily trafficked by heavy truckloads carrying aggregates, 11 axle trucks, and of course, experiencing severe winter weather that we have here. That combination is very destructive to normal concrete. But the bendable concrete laid down there as a patch material outlasts the regular repair mortar by many, many years.
I'm sure you've been crunching numbers and kind of projecting. Could you give us an idea? For example, I could see this being fabulously useful for bridge building, and we know that the typical bridge in the United States was built to last about 50 years. Mm-hmm. What do you think, if we saw one day where your self-healing concrete was used instead, how different could the life expectancy be?
I think it's fair to expect, let's say, 100 years, a good number, good round number, with very little repair requirements, unlike normal concrete bridges, which require, unfortunately, unexpectedly shorter life than we often design for and requires frequent repairs. So by eliminating frequent repairs, we're going to be saving money in terms of repair cost. We're going to be saving ourselves from traffic jams because of reconstruction events on the roads. Repair cost of our cars when we run into a pothole.
Sure. All of the above, all the things that we're debating in this state.
Exactly.
Well, it certainly is a very, very interesting invention. So what will it take to have the self-healing concrete be used to build roads and bridges in this country?
Well, there is a process in terms of turning research into practice, and we need to go through that process of getting the material into a shape which is commercially available. We are almost at that edge. We need to also transfer this knowledge to practitioners, to designers of roads and bridges, to become familiar with this kind of material, which is very different from normal concrete. So there's that process of getting new technologies and bringing them into practice.
It's a fascinating lesson in inventions, inventive minds, and technology. Victor Lee is the E.B. Wiley Collegiate Chair Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Michigan. It was a pleasure to talk to you, Victor. Thank you so very much.
The pleasure is mine.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. All that rain we're having isn't just making the lawns and flowers grow. It's giving us a bumper crop of mosquitoes. Howard Russell is an entomologist with Michigan State University. And Howard, I kind of remember us being pretty happy in the spring that we didn't have the usual mosquitoes because we had a pretty dry March and April. But here we are, it's July, and we're swatting away mosquitoes. Why is that?
Well, they are terrible, Cindy, and they resulted from all that rain we've had over the past 2 or 3 weeks. Around where I live, I think we're pretty close to 10 inches of rain towards the end of June. And That filled up all the low-lying areas that produce these summer mosquitoes, and as long as that water stays, I'm afraid we're going to be dealing with them for the next few weeks.
And so the mosquitoes couldn't be happier.
Mosquitoes are pretty happy right now, I would think. We have a few that can produce a generation in as little as 5 or 6 days when it's 85 or so degrees. So they are going to continue to produce more mosquitoes as this water stays around. And if we get more rain, and which looks like we're going to over the next week or so, we could be dealing with mosquitoes, you know, well into the month of July.
So it certainly bears repeating about clearing out standing water to cut down on mosquito breeding. But I'm wondering, Howard, we see so many shopping strips and subdivisions with those retention ponds and homes with ornamental ponds. How much are all of those adding to our problem?
Well, as long as the water is moving, mosquito larvae have a difficult time developing in water if there's any kind of movement at all. And if we change the water out every few days, that will help. And these little ponds that have the fountains, that's probably enough water motion to keep mosquitoes at a minimum. And certainly, if water's there long enough, they will develop a whole community of insects, many of which will feed on mosquito larvae. Yeah. Mosquitoes do best in pools that are temporary because there aren't predator insects that live in that water with them, so they could just reproduce without any sort of natural controls, and that's why we see such large numbers out of these temporary standing water in low-lying areas.
You know, this is a great chance to ask an entomologist something I've always wondered. Is there anything good about mosquitoes? By that, I mean, do they serve any purpose in the insect world, or are they just put on this earth to bug us?
Well, you know, I get asked, you know, what purpose is that insect? And I think we as humans like to think that everything relates to us. And that's not true. You know, for any biological organism, their purpose is to produce more of their kind. And that's what mosquitoes do. I mean, their goal is to reproduce and put their genetic material in the next generation, and that way they're a biological success, and that's what drives them as an organism, just like it drives us.
Howard Russell is a Michigan State University entomologist. Howard, thanks for sharing your mosquito knowledge with us, and let's look forward to cooler weather in fall, and we can stop slapping at ourselves.
All right, Cindy, thanks for having me on.
We want to think that if someone is sexually assaulted, he or she would be able to go to the proper authorities, report it, and see the perpetrator tried in a court of law with an appropriate punishment. But it's not working that way in America's military. Accusing someone of sexual assault can hurt you career-wise, socially, administratively. The Department of Defense tells us 20,000 service members experienced at least one sexual assault in 2014. And that rate is virtually unchanged since 2010, despite the Pentagon's insistence that it has tackled this problem. And the U.S. Senate just missed another chance to help even the playing field for sexual assault plaintiffs. Colonel Don Christensen is former chief prosecutor of the U.S. Air Force, where he tried over 150 courts-martial as a trial and defense counsel, and he presided over 90 trials as a military judge. Today, he's president of Protect Our Defenders. The group's mission is to end what it calls the epidemic of military rape. Colonel Christensen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I would like to give our listeners first a sense of your military roots and your military career so they understand how deep they are. Your family military ties, go back as far as the Battle of Little Bighorn?
Yes, my great-great-grandfather served as 7th Cavalry. And was at the Battle of Bighorn, was wounded. My grandfather was career force. My dad was career force. And I spent 23 years in the Air Force myself.
And your active service began July 1991. When did you leave the military and why?
I officially retired on 1 January of this year, but I went on terminal leave in October of 2014. And the reason I left was because over the course of my 23-year career, I had seen how military justice was handled, and I knew it needed to be changed.
And you were the guy doing that. So this is someone who had spent his career in these military courtrooms. When and how did the disillusion and the disappointment set in for you, Colonel?
Well, it probably started about 15 years ago when I got an experience level enough that I was looking big picture, not just the court in front of me, and seeing how the system just wasn't fair to the accused or fair to survivors of sexual assault. And then in 2012, I prosecuted a case in Italy, U.S. v. Wilkerson case, which was overturned by a general after we got a conviction. And that kind of was like the last straw for me because I saw that justice wasn't done by the facts. Justice was done by who you knew.
And now you're president of Protect Our Defenders, trying to end military rape. What do you most want the public to realize and to understand about sexual assault in the military?
Sexual assault is pervasive. It is something that impacts the ability of the military to do its mission. It is driving good men and women out of the military and keeping good men and women from coming into the military. And it is something that a survivor of sexual assault is rarely ever going to see justice for what's happened to them.
And it seems as we talk about this, Colonel, that there are some key components that we need to tackle. The actual assaults, and then what happens when a victim reports a crime, if they do, and then what happens in the courtroom when one of these cases actually gets there. So let's start, if we will, with the commission of the crime. And for years, we have heard the military tell us there's zero tolerance for sexual assault. So why is it that the sexual assault rate is basically where it was in 2010? That's more than 4 years ago and no improvement.
I would say it's two things. It's a leadership failure in the DOD because they aren't sending a clear message to the 1.2 million men and women in the military that sexual assault will be handled seriously because they are talking on both sides of their mouth. The second part of it is obstruction. They're obstructing any kind of real fundamental change that will improve our ability to hold people responsible.
So perpetrators probably feel pretty safe. Is it safe to say that?
I'll give you an example. So in 2014, we had about 20,000 sexual assaults. Of those 20,000 sexual assaults, probably about 200 people are convicted, maybe 300. And so the odds are astronomically in your favor. If you commit a sexual assault, you'll never be held responsible.
And I think the public might be surprised to realize that the numbers that we're getting from DOD, that 20,000 some, that doesn't include civilian employees, spouses, kids, or members of the public both at home and abroad?
That's kind of the untold story, is we have civilians work on base who are sexually assaulted. We have husbands and wives and children that are sexually assaulted that don't count. And then, you know, the people in the local community that are sexually assaulted that aren't counted in those numbers.
And then tell us what you've seen happen when a victim actually steps forward, goes to a commanding officer to report the assault.
When a victim comes forward, she runs a gauntlet. Or he runs a gauntlet of oppression from the leadership. They are viewed as the one who has done something wrong. They often face retaliation. About 60% of survivors are retaliated against. And this is severe retaliation, career-ending retaliation, where they're kicked out of the service, they're ostracized within their unit. And they will often see their commander that the DOD keeps saying is supporting them, supporting instead, they're rapists. They'll see their commander testify for the rapist.
Why is that? The system seems very much, you know, there for the commander. And I got to imagine that looks pretty bad for a commander's record if they have a convicted rapist.
You know, those who oppose fundamental change keep saying we need to hold commanders more responsible. The reality is it's impossible to hold commanders responsible. We have this concept called unlawful command influence, where you cannot in any way discourage somebody from supporting an accused. And so commander is free to do that to a degree he wants to do and will never be held accountable. You know, and then for all the talk about holding commanders more responsible, DOD can't show a single time a commander has been held responsible.
Give us some of what you've seen over your years in the courtroom that kind of illustrates how skewed this is.
Well, I can give you a classic example in the case we did, the Wilkerson case, which really highlighted and brought this issue before Congress. He was supported by over 30 commanders. Many of them showed up in the trial and testified for him and say how great of an airman he was, how great of a pilot he was. These are people from lieutenant colonels to four-star generals. And despite the jury convicting him, another three-star general who had the power to overturn the case, based upon all the support he got from commanders, said, I think he's innocent, set him free.
I think most people listening to us talk right now, I know my jaw hit the ground when I read that. Something called Article 60 allows that commander to overturn the verdict, basically ignore the jury's decision?
Yes, and that thankfully has been changed, and that's just went into effect. And that is something the Protector of Defenders is very proud of, because we were able to push that reform through. So that has been stripped from commanders.
That at least you've been able to accomplish. I'm speaking with Colonel Don Christensen. He's the former chief prosecutor of the U.S. Air Force and now president of Protect Our Defenders. This group's mission is to end what it calls an epidemic of sexual assault in the military. Colonel, give us a sense. As you say, this Article 60 has just been amended, so now a commander cannot overturn the verdict, although in this big case that you prosecuted, that's what happened. But what are some of the other different ways that procedures in a military courtroom happen than what we are familiar with in a civilian courtroom?
Sure. Well, fundamentally, in the civilian system, the district attorney or the U.S. attorney, they're the ones who are in charge of the prosecution. And so they're making the prosecution decisions. They're determining what witnesses to call, whether or not to use experts, you know, what the charges are going to be, if charges should be amended or charges should be dropped, whether or not to appeal a decision by the trial judge if he suppresses evidence. Under our system, instead of a prosecutor making that decision, that's made by a general officer who could be a pilot, could be an artillery officer. They're not lawyers. They're making all those decisions. They decide what the charges will be. They decide if they'll go to court. They decide if you could use expert witnesses, for example. So instead of having a independent professional trained and experienced lawyer make those decisions, we're having lay people make the decisions.
And the U.S. Senate just failed to pass legislation that you strongly believe would help fix some of this. It's New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand's Military Justice Improvement Act, the MJIA. What would that act do?
What that act would do would shift that decision authority from a few select generals to independent military prosecutors of a senior rank who have experience in prosecuting serious crimes. And so the decisions being made on whether or not to go forward on a case based on the facts, not based upon the inherent bias of the commander.
And they didn't pass that, and I know there's been a couple of attempts to do so, and the Pentagon claims the MJIA isn't needed, and the sexual assault problem in the military is improving, and that it would erode a commander's authority. And your response?
Absolutely false. First, what MJIA does, it takes the power away from less than 3% of the commanders. 97% of the commanders will have exactly the same power they have now. It's just what we call a convening authority, the person who sends a case to trial. Second, what it will do is give confidence to survivors that their case will be handled fairly and impartially. And on the flip side, it will give confidence to people who are accused of a crime that their case will be handled fairly and impartially. Because right now we have some commanders sending everything to trial. And that's no better than not sending anything to trial. You know, I no more want guilty people to go free than I want innocent people to be convicted.
Colonel, I take it from looking through the Protect Our Defenders website, you and the group have no doubt that there are post 9/11 veterans right here in Michigan, perhaps listening to us talk right now, who were sexual assault victims, who either did not report the assault or did so in a way that would keep the crime from being investigated and prosecutors because they were afraid of retaliation, or who went to trial with unsatisfactory results. What have you seen that do to the vets?
Oh, it's horrible. I can give you a great statistic on that. Women veterans, homeless women veterans, over 40% of homeless women veterans were victims of sexual assault while they're in the military. You can just logically make the conclusion that that has lifelong severe consequences for so many of our survivors. They have over a million VA visits each year associated with military sexual trauma. So it is something that follows them forever, especially when they have had the very institution that they love turn its back on them.
What would you say to the people who are listening to us talk right now, Michigan men and women who may be considering joining the military, or to those of us who have parents who have kids of age who could be considering joining the military?
I would say to go in with your eyes wide open to understand this is a serious issue, and that we need to put pressure on Congress to get this changed, because, you know, I love the military. I've dedicated so many years of my life to the military, my family has, and I want to see the best it can possibly be, and it's failing right now.
Would you want your kids or your grandkids to be in a uniform right now the way things are?
You know, that is a very tough question for me. I'd have a long talk with my children if they wanted to go in.
Hmm. And then, as you say, eyes open, but there are stories that veterans have shared on the Protect Our Defenders website, even that even people that did have their eyes open, something happens. There was one father whose daughter, they said, committed suicide, but then her obvious injuries belied that.
Yeah, it's a very sad case. And that's something that the American people need to understand, that military sexual assault is different than other sexual assault for so many reasons. And one of them being is that sexual assault is always bad, but if you're a civilian employee at Walmart and you're sexually assaulted, you probably don't work with that person. And you're free to quit Walmart if you do work for Walmart. You can try to get that person fired if you work there. But in the military, your entire life is going to be with that person who has sexually assaulted you, and you're going to be working with his friends. And it's such a closed community of trust. When that's violated, the impact is lifelong.
Colonel Don Christensen is president of Protect Our Defenders, and he's the former chief prosecutor of the United States Air Force. You can learn more by going to the group's website, which is protectourdefenders.com. Colonel Christensen, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
And thank you so much.
And tomorrow, as our series continues on returning veterans, when a civilian meets a military veteran, the conversation can be less than fulfilling.
The individual stops what they're doing and says, "Oh, thank you so much for your service." And then they kind of freeze up and they don't know what else to say.
What to say when you want to thank a vet? That's tomorrow as Beyond the Battlefield continues right here on Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Today's engineer was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Ryan Grimes, Ava Obrecht, Jake Offenhartz, Shana Roth, and Katrina Schaefer. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.